This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is an all-in-one management software with apps for every business need. Odoo has apps for CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, manufacturing, and everything in between, and they're all in one easy-to-use software. And the best part about Odoo? All Odoo apps are integrated, helping you get things done faster and more efficiently. So when you think about business, think Odoo. To learn more, visit odoo.com/reveal. That's odoo.com/reveal.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. And today, we're talking about the future and what it takes to build it as a worker in Silicon Valley. Take Tesla. The carmaker's working towards a future of electric vehicles that drive themselves while we can relax and tweet. It's been a crucial year for the 15-year-old company. Tesla's trying to prove that it can mass-produce electric cars and turn a profit with its new, more affordable Model 3.
This is the Tesla Model 3, the car that over 400,000 people have been waiting for.
For the first time in 2 years, the company turned a profit this past quarter. But there have been some stumbles along the way. In September, Fed sued CEO Elon Musk for a misleading tweet about taking his company private. Musk had to step down as chair of Tesla's board of directors. Musk sent out some tweets about us, too. He called a story we did about unsafe working conditions at Tesla BS and propaganda. Then he started attacking the news media in general.
I guess in a sense, his rant and ramble here on these tweets is not dissimilar from something we hear from the president quite often, that he feels
not
like he's a victim of fake news.
Musk even called Reveal just some rich kids in Berkeley who took their political science professor too seriously. But hey, Twitter burns can't stop us. In fact, our reporter Will Evans has continued reporting on safety problems there, and we've got a brand new investigation today. Here's Will.
At the end of August, I get this email. It's from someone named Anna Watson. She says she's been working at the health clinic at Tesla's factory in Fremont, California. She's a physician assistant. That's a medical professional who provides care under the supervision of a doctor. The email says she was fired that day. She writes, I can tell you exactly what they are doing and how they're risking the safety of patients and increasing the risk of accidents. So I jump on it. I drive down to the southern part of Silicon Valley to meet with her at a Starbucks. She's never done this before, so she's nervous, a little shaky.
Okay, go ahead. I'm going to try to answer the question. Nervous energy, but I'm going to try to stay focused on what you want to know.
No, I want to know it all.
Anna is a 49-year-old mother of three. She sounds earnest, like she just has to get this off her chest and hopes everything will work out okay. She'd only worked at the clinic for a few weeks, but right from the beginning, she saw problems.
You know, at first you see something and you're like, you know, okay, this is a little bad, but I'm going to try to work with it. And I still was trying to do what I felt I could for people.
Anna has nearly 20 years' experience as a physician assistant, examining patients, diagnosing ailments, and prescribing medications. She's treated patients at a steel plant, a petroleum refinery, emergency rooms, even a trauma center. She tells me Tesla workers are not getting the care they need, and that she was a part of it. She says Tesla wanted to bring down the number of injuries that had to be recorded on company logs.
I just decided I can't just keep, looking the other way. They have a protocol that is committed to discharging every single patient, really without providing any kind of treatment or intervention that would make it a recordable. The little stuff that I was trying to let go, I just couldn't.
All of this was taking place after we reported in April that the electric car maker had a serious problem with employee safety. Anna reached out to me because she saw her first story. Before we go on, let me tell you a little bit about our original investigation that we co-reported with KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. It started with a bunch of 911 calls from Tesla.
They have an associate with a cut on his wrist, and it's pretty deep.
911?
He reported to the guard that his finger is near falling off.
Okay, where's the patient?
We just have an associate up in our medical offices that they want to get to the hospital because he has chest pains and he's vomiting.
Okay, and what...
Tesla had been under fire for having a higher injury rate than the industry average. It said it brought that number down, but we discovered that Tesla wasn't counting all of its injuries as required by law. And former Tesla safety professionals told us their concerns were ignored. We took a tour of the factory. Some dangerous spots on the factory floor weren't marked with yellow, the standard color for safety, because Elon Musk didn't like the color.
Well, yeah, he wanted the plant to be specific colors, so everything had to be red, gray, had to be red and gray.
We talked with Tesla about what we found, and the company denied it all. But right after our story, California's Workplace Safety Agency, Cal OSHA, opened an investigation.
All of this comes just a couple of days after Reveal published an investigative piece saying that Tesla was, in fact, underreporting workplace injuries. So, guys, this is yet another headline headache for Tesla.
It turns out Cal OSHA's ability to enforce the law on counting injuries was pretty weak. The agency only had about 6 months from the date of an injury to fine a company. And these kinds of violations usually take time to catch. After we reported that, California lawmakers passed a bill giving Cal OSHA more time to investigate. Elon Musk is still talking about what we found and denying it. Just as we were wrapping up this story and pushing Tesla for answers, Musk went on the offensive during a call with investors and analysts.
We do get these, like, quite unfair, accusations. For example, one of them was, like, that we were underreporting injuries.
And
Lori Shelby, Tesla's vice president for safety, bragged about the factory's health center. After our first story, they hired a new company to run it.
So when injuries do occur, we get the absolute best care for our associates. I'm really super happy with the care they're giving, and I think the employees are as well.
Anna, who sent me the email about poor treatment for injured workers, joined that new clinic in August. But she says she found the company was still more concerned with making its safety record look good than with treating workers. After our coffee on the first day we met, Anna and I went to Chili's for lunch, and she told me about some of the things that were happening on the factory floor.
Oh, I had this patient, and a trunk fell on him, and he was in such
severe... Like a car trunk?
Uh-huh.
She didn't tell me his name, but later on, I was able to get a copy of Tesla's official injury list and started contacting injured workers. I got a guy named Stefan Nelson on the phone, and he started telling me about how a trunk fell on his back. I realized this must be the guy Anna was talking about, so I go to see him.
So what do you got there?
These are my documents from when I had to go to the health center.
We're sitting in folding chairs outside his girlfriend's house in Oakland, where dogs, cars, and trains are passing by. He's a big athletic guy, 30 years old. He used to play semi-pro football. But since getting hurt at Tesla, he gets up slowly and walks a little hunched over to one side. On August 13th, he was working the late shift, putting some caulk on the inside of a Tesla trunk on the production line.
And before I knew it, I just felt a heavy object just hit the middle of my back.
The hatchback had swung down.
I stood up straight for like a quick second. Everybody was asking if I was all right, and my whole back just locked up. I couldn't walk. I couldn't sit down. I couldn't even stand up straight.
He says the pain was unbearable. He had deep red bruises across his back and asked his supervisors to call an ambulance.
They were saying that they couldn't because it'll cost Tesla a lot of money, so they just had to wait to see what the Tesla doctor said. And the first time we asked the Tesla doctor if they could call the ambulance because they saw how much pain I was in, he said no.
Anna said even she, as a trained medical professional, wasn't allowed to call 911. It had to be approved by a doctor who rarely okayed it. And there was something else Anna told me that surprised me.
There was a strong
push not to send anybody in an ambulance to the extent that they would even call a patient a Lyft to have them transferred to the hospital that way.
Sending patients to the ER in a Lyft, that means no emergency medical care on the way to the hospital. It's a judgment call by the doctor, but it struck a lot of people in the factory as inhumane.
When the security guard called the doctor three times to see if they could call the ambulance because he was even worried about my pain, and the doctor told him no, but they could call a Lyft to send me to the hospital. I'm like, what is the point of a Lyft? Like, I can't sit up straight. I can't walk or do anything.
What did you think of that? I mean, what were you thinking when they said that?
What kind of company am I working for? I just felt heartbroken because it seemed like what they was telling us in the orientation, that Tesla is a company that cares about their employee safety. It just seemed like it was just a whole reversal.
Stefan ends up calling his girlfriend to take him to the emergency room. But his supervisor tells him he has to show up for work the next day or else he'll get written up. He needs the job, so he tries.
I couldn't even get out the car to even get to my department. I tried to let the supervisor know, but it's like they're only caring about one thing, and that's trying to make their goal, which is trying to make sure that all the cars get done complete.
He eventually shuffles in pain over to his department. He obviously can't do the job, so they send him to the health center. And here's where it gets really bizarre. Normally, a worker who's too injured to do their regular job will be given an easier one, so they don't make the injury worse. They get work restrictions, like don't lift more than 20 pounds. But Anna says that wasn't allowed.
And we were always required to bring the patient back just to their full duty job.
Why? What's the point of that?
Because it keeps the patient off of their records. It keeps the patient off of their books. So 100% the goal of the clinic was to keep as many patients off of the books as possible.
So the health center lets Stefan go home for the day, but they tell him he has to come back to work the next day full duty. This happened over and over until Anna finally sent Stefan to an outside clinic. It's run by the same company that manages the clinic at the factory, but there, at least, providers are allowed to give work restrictions. But it can take a long time to get an appointment. Stefan was diagnosed with a crushing injury, with bruises and intractable pain. 8 days after his injury, he was finally given work restrictions. Don't bend, squat, climb stairs, or lift more than 10 pounds. In the end, Stefan's injury had to go on Tesla's books. And Anna says that's another reason the system doesn't make sense. Some workers whose injuries are so serious they'll eventually have to be counted are still denied appropriate care when they're hurting the most. Can you give me like a rundown of just the kinds of things that people would be sent back to their jobs with?
It was anything. It was everything. Cuts, lacerations, burns, sprained ankles, back pain, back strain, shoulder injuries, elbow injuries, wrist injuries from torque guns. If you couldn't walk out, it didn't matter.
She says there were other strategies to keep the injury rates down. Like the clinic would decide that some injuries were not work-related even before patients were fully evaluated. There was a culture, she says, of just blowing off patients. Some temp workers who were hurt in the factory were simply turned away from the clinic. I talked to a couple of them who said they couldn't get help, and their names didn't show up on Tesla's official list of injuries. I showed Anna the injury list for the time period she was there. Is that an undercount?
By far. By far. It was more than twice that many people daily that should have been considered a serious injury or illness based on the OSHA standards.
And they're just not on the list?
No, they're not on the list. Those people wouldn't make it to the list because we never gave them the treatment they deserved.
Anna tells me that Tesla was so concerned about keeping its injury rate down that one time company officials told clinic staff to stop prescribing exercises to injured workers so they wouldn't be counted. By late August, Anna reached her breaking point.
You just can't participate in a system like that that is not going to consider treating the patient and doing what's appropriate for the patient.
She got into an argument with the clinic owner, and he fired her for not deferring to doctors. That's when she contacted me.
I just see the workers at Tesla as having, like, absolutely no voice. I do feel, like, extra responsible to try to speak up for what's going on there.
At the same time, Anna sent a complaint to Cal OSHA, the workplace safety agency. She wasn't expecting the response she got. Cal OSHA sent her a letter saying they folded her complaint into the investigation they started right after our first story ran. They didn't mention they had already closed that investigation 2 weeks before Anna's complaint and only fined Tesla $400 for a single violation. Anna got on the phone to insist that they investigate, and she says they told her that it wasn't their responsibility, that she should try contacting other agencies.
I don't see how Cal OSHA is not responsible for that.
Cal OSHA Chief Julianne Sum wouldn't do an interview. But as Anna kept pushing and we started asking questions, a Cal OSHA spokeswoman said Anna's complaint now is being investigated. We wanted to talk to Tesla too, but they turned down our interview requests. Anna wasn't the only one who said Tesla pressured the clinic to dismiss injuries. I talked to another former clinic employee who said a Tesla official would routinely contact the head doctor about specific workers and lean on the clinic to downplay and disregard the injuries. The former employee requested anonymity for fear of being blackballed in the industry. So I asked the head doctor about it.
So it's actually quite the opposite. What Tesla pressures us on is accurate documentation.
Dr. Basil Besch owns Access Omnicare, which Tesla hired to run its on-site health center. He'd submitted a proposal that he could help lower the company's injury numbers. Tesla set up the call with him and listened in. He says Tesla does ask doctors for more clarity on specific cases because they want their injury log to be as accurate as possible.
They are not in the business of making clinical determinations at all. We make those clinical determinations only based on what the patient needs.
I ask him about sending injured workers back to the assembly line without any work restrictions.
There's always going to be somebody who says, you know, I shouldn't be working. But if you look objectively at the totality of the medical examination, that's not always the case.
I ask him about Stefan, who had a car trunk fall on his back and was sent back to work when he could barely walk. The doctor says he can't comment on any specific patient without an okay from that person, but he does say that a physician must have determined that there wasn't a safety issue.
So culturally, there were folks in the past who were expecting that anytime they come to the clinic, they would be taken off of work. And when we told them, no, we really want to do what's best for you, it's taking some time to get buy-in.
I've been told that the on-call doctor often says not to call 911 and instead recommends patients go to the hospital in a Lyft.
Well, you're talking to the on-call doctor, so that would be correct. We right-size the care, right?
He gives an example of a Tesla worker who had the top of his finger cut off. He said the guy needed to go to the hospital, but not in an ambulance. But you do send people to the emergency room in a Lyft.
We send people to emergency room by transport if they don't need an ambulance. That's correct.
Okay.
I hope this makes your article, Will. Dr. Besch said, not all patients who go to the emergency room are taken by ambulance.
I called up a couple of the medical assistants who worked the night shift at the clinic, sometimes alone. They saw a lot of the same things Anna was telling me. They said they felt overwhelmed with patients and really uncomfortable with the doctor's orders to call a Lyft, including for a worker whose fingers were broken and mangled and another worker who was lightheaded and dizzy. But the doctor takes issue with a lot of the things his former employees say. He dismisses Anna as a short-timer who got fired for working outside her scope. He says the whole thing about not prescribing exercises was only for workers who weren't actually injured. And as for the temp workers who weren't treated at the clinic, he says that's just an administrative problem, and they're straightening it out. Overall, the doctor said Tesla provides its workers top-notch care.
we treat the Tesla employees just the same way we treat our professional athletes. If Steph Curry twists his knee on a Thursday night game, that guy's in the MRI scanner on Friday morning, and you're coming back.
I called up Anna to tell her what her former boss said. She called it a ridiculous statement. Anna has a new job now at an urgent care clinic, but she still worries about the Tesla workers who could suffer long-term damage from not getting the care they need.
You go to Tesla and you think it's going to be this innovative, great, wonderful place to be, like this kind of futuristic company. And I guess it's just kind of disappointing that that's our future, basically, where the worker still doesn't matter.
Our story was produced by Reveal's Will Evans and Catherine Miskowski. By the way, on the day Stefan Nelson was talking to Will, Stefan got a new job offer.
I feel ecstatic. Something told me like today was just going to be a good day. Now I can actually quit working at Tesla.
When are you going to quit?
Today.
It's not just worker safety that companies in Silicon Valley are under fire for. It's their hiring practices. When we come back, we'll have a report card on who gets the jobs and who holds the power in high tech. You're listening to Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. A network of anti-democratic groups are attacking these freedoms, seeking to force us all to live by their narrow beliefs. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/MJ.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Today, we're talking about Silicon Valley and the things tech companies don't want you to know about their workplace. For Tesla, it's worker injuries. For other companies, it's who actually gets to work there. I don't mean their names, but their gender and race. We have a lot of data to help tell this story, but the numbers are really hard to talk about on the radio. So we decided to get some help from a choir. We're at the First Unitarian Church of Oakland, which is not far from a lot of these companies.
This is a beautiful building. The sun is setting outside and you can see like the last glimmer of light coming through the stained glass windows here.
And yes, we're here to sing about the data.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
The choir is made up of church members and Reveal fans. And the numbers were put together by our colleague, Sanduja Ragarajan, who's a data reporter at Reveal.
We're here to tell the story of diversity in Silicon Valley.
We did this with Sanduja earlier this year when she came up with her initial findings. She's kept on digging, and today we're going deeper. So here's how it's going to work with the choir. We divided the singers up and had them sing different parts, representing who's working in big tech companies. The more singers you hear, the larger that group is.
So basically, we're going to group people off according to what their numbers would be in Silicon Valley.
Yes. What okay. The average percentages in a tech company would be. Yes.
Is this my company?
Is this your company? Yeah. You get to be the CEO.
There are no black CEOs. No,
not too many. Actually,
I'm joking.
Not too many. You're right about that.
So the first thing we looked at was executives.
Okay. So Sanduja, first we'll start off with the black executive, which since this is my tech company, this would be where I would sing at, correct?
Yes.
All right. So let's hear black executive. How did I get such a good voice? Then we brought in Hispanic and Latino executives. Okay, those are just two voices, yeah?
Yes.
And then Asian executives. That's a lot more. So there's a big difference there.
Yes.
And then what about the number one group? Wow. There are that many white executives than black executives?
The percentage, yes, yes.
What, give me the numbers.
It's like 73% white executives, 21% on an average Asian executives, 3% on an average Latino executives, and 1.39% black executives.
Wow. I mean, we knew that there was disparity, but I didn't realize it was that bad.
Yes, it's that bad. Especially at the executive rung, it is that bad. And executives make all the decisions.
Which means they decide what gets made and how it's going to work.
These companies are making products that define our lives. For example, companies like Slack and Square, these are products that we use every day. And they didn't have any black or Hispanic executives in 2016. It's been really hard to get companies to release this data, and most of them want to keep it quiet.
So how did you get your hands on it?
So my co-reporter Will Evans and I did a lot of things. We filed public records requests. We collaborated with a sociology professor who's been studying high-tech workplaces. We asked the companies to give it to us. And we even sued the Department of Labor, and that's still ongoing. And as we've been reporting about this, we've been able to get data from more and more companies. So it's been difficult, but not impossible.
So what else were you able to learn from it, like about women?
We learned that around 80% of Silicon Valley executives are men. And there are six companies that have no female executives. We don't know which ones because we got this data from the professor and he couldn't share the names. And among the female executives, white women dominate. Black women
executives, Okay, so that was executives, but what about the rest of the workforce?
It does get more diverse as you go down the ladder, but the numbers are still troubling. There are some companies that have no black women at all, 10 companies. Again, we don't know who they are. But I can tell you about this one company that I do know, Bloom Energy, a green tech company that recently went public. They had 842 people working there in 2016. Only two of them were black women, and they weren't making the big bucks.
Okay, Sanduja, now I am totally depressed.
Well, it's not all bad news. What really surprised me is that some companies were doing better than others. And so more diversity is not this unattainable goal to achieve.
Okay, so give me some hope here. Tell me what it is.
So there's this company called Penumbra that you've probably never heard of. Mm-mm. They make medical devices. And the Googles and the Facebooks of the world have something to learn from them. Because Penumbra ranks number one in professional women. And that's number one out of the 177 of the largest tech companies.
What do you think they're doing right?
We went to talk to their CEO, Adam Elsesser, at his office in Alameda to find out.
Hi, Sanduja. Nice to meet you.
I'm Adam.
He told us that if you want to be a diverse company, you really have to be one from the very beginning.
Our first employee, our first engineer, was a woman.
And she was well-known and respected in the field. That may have helped attract other women. And you know, a majority of Silicon Valley companies were founded by men, and they tend to hire people they know, mostly other men.
But some companies say that they can't hire women because there aren't enough qualified women candidates in the job pool.
Yes, I've also heard that a lot. But here's what Adam had to say.
We just not found that to be true. And that may be in part because we already have such a diverse workforce that it's an appealing place for people to apply.
Okay, but diversity isn't just about who you hire, right?
Yeah, it's about building a culture where people also want to stay. Adam gave us an example of how that's working at Penumbra.
We also, regardless of one's gender, try to really give credit to the person who's actually doing the work. You know, sometimes 23 years old, right out of school, is getting sort of acknowledged and public credit for it. It really empowers everybody. And we've had a number of those examples where those people were women. And I think that has helped.
Yeah, that
doesn't happen that often. I mean, that's a pretty big deal. So what advice did he have for other Silicon Valley companies like, I don't know, let's say Google?
Let's hear.
I don't want to be at all presumptuous to tell other companies how to run their business. I don't think you will be successful if you're trying to create a more diverse workforce for the goal of saying you created a diverse workforce. It has to be something deeper than that. It has to just be what you do. I am 100% convinced has added greatly to our success.
And Adam's just one CEO speaking out of his experience, but all of the academic literature also points to the same thing, that a more diverse workforce is actually better for business.
His advice sounds so simple, but so many companies struggle with this. Even Google, where for years their code of conduct was, don't be evil.
It is a struggle for them. In fact, this year, Google released a report. And the report acknowledged that it is having trouble retaining its black employees.
Thanks, Sanduja. Sanduja Raghurajan is a data reporter at Reveal. We were just talking about Google, and for Kelly Ellis, landing a job there was a very big deal. It was 2010, she was 25, and she'd worked hard to get there. She had the degree, a college minor in computer science, and she had the experience, 4 years as a software engineer. Like every new hire, she was given this colorful baseball cap with a propeller on it called a Noogler hat. Then she was whisked through orientation.
I was excited. It was like a lot of information. It was a lot to take in, but I was like, this is going to be great.
As one of Google's 20,000 or so employees at the time, Kelly dove into the work. But it wasn't long before she started noticing things that didn't sit well with her. Little hints about salaries at Google. It seemed like her male colleagues were making more money.
I remember talking to other women engineers about their similar frustrations. I think I just didn't want to believe that Google could be evil when it comes down to it.
Kelly isn't at Google anymore. And when she left, her plan was to put the experience behind her and move on with her career. And that's just what she did. Until other people, including the federal government, started seeing the same red flags. And now, Kelly finds herself in a high-profile battle against one of the largest companies in the world. She's suing Google for discrimination. We first aired this story in the spring when we teamed up with a Decrypted podcast from Bloomberg News. We wanted to understand why Kelly and other women who worked at Google believe the company didn't pay them fairly. Bloomberg's Ellen Hewitt and Aki Ito investigate.
Kelly is on her second job since she left Google. She works out of Oakland for a tech startup, and we recently caught up over lunch.
Hey.
Hi.
Hey, nice to see you.
Good to see you.
How's it going?
Good. I've never been here for lunch before.
I haven't either.
I've been following Kelly on Twitter for years, way before this lawsuit started, because she's been so vocal about her experience as a woman in tech. She has a tiny gold septum ring in her nose and wears glasses that she nudges with the back of her hand.
Do you guys want to do anything besides water to drink? Are we?
I'm fine with water. Can you tell me the
possibility? I'm surprised by how approachable she is in person because she's pretty salty online. Aki and I first met Kelly at her lawyer's office, and she talked to us about her time at Google. She says that she started seeing the warning signs almost immediately when she learned she'd be working with what's called front-end code.
And that was really, really surprising to me because it was really different from what I had been doing before. I would say a lot of people in the software world looked at front-end engineering as something that, like, you didn't need a degree to do.
This is an important distinction in software engineering. Front-end coding, which Kelly was assigned to, focuses on what the consumer sees in their browser. Back-end coding interacts with the plumbing, like servers and databases, and that's what Kelly had done before she came to Google.
And I very quickly noticed that that was where all of my women colleagues were working, was in front-end engineering. So I was like, that's kind of annoying. But at the same time, I was still like, well, I'm at Google, though, you know?
At Google, everyone has a level, starting at level one for interns and hourly workers, up to level 10 or higher for top executives. The higher you are, the more you tend to get paid. And Kelly started to suspect that she was hired at the wrong level.
I had had another software engineer join my same team the week after I did. And he and I both graduated in the same year, but he was level 4 when I was level 3.
On top of that, there was a whole group of new grads straight out of college who joined a couple months after Kelly.
They were all starting at the same level that I was at. And that was when I was like, this feels wrong. But when I would ask people about it, they would say, well, you know, we sometimes downslot people and then we'll just correct it come promotion time.
Kelly applied for a promotion. She says the committee reviewing her application agreed she was doing the work of a level 4, but they didn't promote her because she hadn't been at Google long enough to show an upward trajectory.
And that was when I realized, like, that I was always going to be playing catch-up. Because, like, by the time that I was going for promotion from 4 to 5, like, the people who were 4 were already at level 5. So I was frustrated, but I was still like, well, it's still Google, you know? I don't think I considered quitting.
Did you ever talk about that with a manager or maybe like an HR rep?
Not with an HR rep, but with managers. And again, I was just sort of told, like, trust the system. Like, it didn't seem like there was any remedy.
Kelly later did get promoted twice and was able to move into a back-end engineering team. But after 4 years, she quit to go work for a smaller company where she felt she'd have more opportunities to grow. She tried to put her experiences at Google behind her.
I kind of always felt like, yes, this probably has something to do with my gender, but I like fell through the cracks somehow, you know, and my case isn't typical.
3 years later, in 2017, Kelly was browsing the news online when she saw an article about a government investigation into Google. In a court hearing, a lawyer with the Department of Labor said that they'd found evidence of systemic compensation disparities at the company.
I mean, I was like, but I was like, okay, like, now this is getting real. And I read the article and I was like, yep.
Learning about the government's investigation made Kelly see her experience in a different light.
Around the same time, a San Francisco lawyer named Jim Finberg read about the same investigation. Jim's a lawyer at the firm Altshuler Burzon, and he specializes in workplace discrimination cases. He remembers how struck he was by the statistical claims cited by the Department of Labor about the alleged difference in what Google paid women and what it paid men. The government found a gap so significant that it was incredibly unlikely for it to have happened by chance. Basically, about 1 in 100 million. Jim compares it to a coin toss.
So if I flip a coin, there's a 1 in 2 chance that it'll be heads. If I flip a coin 1,000 times and it's only heads once out of 1,000 times, well, that's a lot more suspicious than if it's once out of 2 times.
Jim discussed the government's findings with a couple other lawyers, and they decided to ask former and current Google employees to get in touch if they were interested in talking.
We put a post on the internet and didn't necessarily think we would get much of a response, but we got called by about 80 to 100 women who said, yeah, it's terrible. Women are paid less than men for the same work.
Kelly was one of the women who saw Jim's post. She filled out an online form and then met Jim and his colleagues to tell her story in person. And she heard the other women's stories, too.
I felt that I was finally realizing that this wasn't a well-intended accident. And I'm not saying that they set out to discriminate against women, but I fully believe that they know about the problem and decided not to fix it.
Kelly agreed to be a named plaintiff, along with two other women. Represented by Jim, the three women filed a lawsuit in September 2017. In the complaint, they said that Google pays women less than men for equal or similar work. They also said that the company puts women on career paths with lower pay ceilings. The lawsuit made international news.
Welcome back. Alphabet investors this morning shaking off concerns over the gender discrimination lawsuit filed against Google yesterday. Now, according to court documents,
the lawsuit accuses Google of pay discrimination against women. Three women who used to work for Google filed the suit yesterday. They claim the tech giant is...
Google declined our request for an interview, but the company has denied the allegations detailed in the lawsuit. The company published a blog post in the spring that addressed pay equity, and the results are very different from the government's findings that we told you about earlier. Google said it reviewed the salaries of 89% of its workforce. It excluded the jobs that it said weren't held by enough workers for the company to run a reliable analysis. For the job categories it examined, Google says it found a pay gap among a tiny group of workers. The company says it has since closed that gap.
Good morning, Ellen. How are you?
I'm good.
Welcome to the Superior Court.
In March, a hearing for Kelly's lawsuit took place in San Francisco. I met up with Jim, the lawyer, outside the courthouse.
Yeah, let's go inside.
Jim has big plans for the lawsuit. He wants it to be a class action case. Today's hearing is to discuss the number of jobs that the proposed class action would cover.
Thank you. Good morning. Please have a seat.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Jim's team argues that 30 different jobs should be included. Google's lawyers argue for a smaller number. The judge, Mary Wiss, rules in favor of Kelly and the other plaintiffs. I catch up with Kelly afterward.
Hey. So, I don't know, was it good?
Yeah, it's good.
And how does it feel to you personally?
Good. I mean, it just feels kind of like another step in the journey. You know, there's a lot more to go, and... So it's not like it feels like a victory, really, but it was the result that we were hoping for. So.
Yeah. And now you have to get to work?
Yeah, not get to go back to work.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Yeah.
Pursuing this case hasn't come without its costs. Because of how vocal she's been on gender issues, Kelly's faced a lot of online harassment over the years. And the lawsuit elevated her profile even more.
What are the kind of things that the online trolls say to you?
I mean, it's anything from, you know, the wage gap isn't real, get back in the kitchen and make me a sandwich, to, like, you deserve to be raped. To teach you a lesson about, you know, going after tech companies because you couldn't cut it as an engineer.
Earlier this year, one of the men who threatened her online got a hold of her phone number and started calling her. When she told him to stop, he told Kelly that he was in her neighborhood and mentioned a restaurant on her block. She filed a restraining order against him. But despite all of that, she says she still doesn't regret speaking up.
I'm so, like, lucky to have had all of the opportunities that landed me in this career. A lot of that comes from my privilege, and I really want other people to have the opportunity, because I do think that, like, technology is the future of the economy, and I want it to be available to everyone and for everyone to have the chance to succeed. And if, you know, entire groups of people are being compensated unfairly or not given the same opportunities because of factors that they can't help, then that's not the kind of industry I want to be in.
For now, Kelly's trying to live her life as normally as possible, going to work, hanging out with friends, as she waits for the suit to move forward. Jim expects to file a motion on her behalf early next year to get the case certified as a class action suit. If approved, that would open it up to thousands of women who've worked at Google.
Our story was reported by Ellen Hewitt and Aki Ito in partnership with Decrypted, a podcast from Bloomberg News. You can find Decrypted wherever you get your podcasts. And in the interest of full disclosure, I've followed Kelly on Twitter for a while. In January, before I even knew we were doing the story, she tweeted that she was being harassed and she was raising money to stay in a hotel. I contributed $50. When we come back, women of color who've worked for Google and other big tech companies talk about how they get ahead in Silicon Valley. That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. We've been talking a lot today about diversity in Silicon Valley, who works there and who doesn't. And we've already heard how hard it is for women, especially women of color. But there are some women of color making it in Silicon Valley, and we wanted to hear from them.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to say my name, where I'm from.
KQED's Christina Kim and Reveal's Sanduja Ragarajan got eight of them together on a Thursday night after work in January.
And you all have to respond to this, too. The theme song that you want to play every time you walk into a room.
Every time I walk into, I think it's going to be Queen.
Oh.
Yeah, I think I like that. I listen to it every day.
These women had come straight from work to meet in a wood-paneled room on the top floor of the San Francisco Public Library over quiche and tea.
And my song would probably be Taylor Swift's Shake It Off.
All these women are successful professionals, product managers, engineers, entrepreneurs.
The only thing that's popping to my head right now is Lucky Star from Madonna, so I'm just going to go with that one.
And they had so much to say about their experiences that they eventually got kicked out of the library because it was closing. Eunjung Lee is a consultant to tech companies. Shanae Levin is a product manager who's worked at eBay and Google. They've both dealt with feeling out of place at the office. Here's Eunjung.
In the startup environments that I've been in, that culture is dominated by tech bros. Tech bros playing video games and calling each other bro and dude. And it's almost like you're forced to channel your own inner tech bro in order to even like pretend like you're relating. And after a while, it becomes exhausting because you're living this like double consciousness.
I make it a point to showcase how similar I am because I already know walking in that I look different. I educate myself on what's happening, current events. So when someone yells Bitcoin out in the middle of the office or Ethereum is dropping like a rock, I'm able to say, oh, that's crazy, blah, 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 blah. And they're like, oh, and they're surprised. And then it gives them the reassurance that I also fit in with this team.
Sukruthra Bhadauria, a senior engineering manager at Salesforce, talked about how some women engineers lack confidence.
When I've had man and a woman report to me, I have to do a lot more to push the woman who's equally or sometimes more competent to take on a new opportunity just because she's a little bit hesitant about how she thinks she will do. So before even trying, there's this doubt factor that comes in.
There's a challenge of asking for the things that you want and being very vocal about the things that you want and that you need. And I've done that.
That was Jennifer Wong, an engineer at Envoy.
But it's a double-edged sword because then you become that vocal, annoying person. I've actually heard in the past that one of my previous managers called me a pain in the ass, which is super funny because I thought he was an amazing manager. And he definitely provided what I needed to move up within the company, but also he thought I was a pain in the ass.
So, right, that's literally the trade-off we have to make every day. Do I want to be liked or do I want the things? So what if you lean into it and actually find some other women, start a thing where the whole point is we're going to be a pain in the ass. Hashtag be a pain in the ass. Whatever, like literally start a movement so that you're taking the critique and you're flipping it.
Big tech companies do have organized diversity efforts, but participating in them can come with a cost. Here's Shanae Levin again.
I was on a diversity committee at Google. We put together proposals and we put together ideas, and there's so many ideas, there's so many things that you could do, but we also had jobs, right? And you have to take time off work, and the ability to get all of those people in a room weekly to make sure that you're tackling the issues and making sure that you're doing everything that you're supposed to do legally as well. There's a lot of other different hurdles that you have to jump through.
Did you ever get paid to do any of this work? Because that sounds like a ton of work.
No.
So, yeah, that's my point is so often we like if we're the only black person in a group, then we get tokenized and asked to do all of this work without being compensated.
Oh, for sure.
And so how do you feel about that?
I have just come to the realization that I'm going to be one of the people responsible for women of color in tech.
But how do you feel about the fact that all of this time and effort that you're pouring into helping the company get more diverse is literally taking away from your time in working on your career?
I don't think about it for the company, right? If I could help a woman of color get into a different company, it's about them as opposed to which company they go to work for. The company should be lucky to have them. It's also about our customers getting better products in their hands. So for me, yes, there is a lot of time and energy that takes, but I'm willing to do it because if I don't, who will?
And I will argue that the company is fully aware that, mm-hmm. that they are getting that from you.
Absolutely.
Yet they are not compensating you for it. They are at best lazy in compensating you and recognizing you in the way you should be. And at worst, like willfully just letting you do it at the expense of your career.
To be candid, I've been in the tech industry for 20 years and we've spent a lot of time, so much time talking about the challenges of diversity and like women getting promoted and the diversity pipeline. Nowadays, I want to see so change from the top down.
Shailin Simmons is an ex-Googler and entrepreneur.
I want to see that there are more women on boards of directors. In the past year, I joined a board of directors for a $1.4 billion business. So I feel that it was important for me as a woman of color to sit at this company and help represent. That's what I'm proud of. I'm trying to do some direct sort of action towards where I think effort is needed.
We're ending our show this week with that anthem of women's empowerment, respect. Respect to all the women who participated in our roundtable, including Shailin Simmons, Ung Jung Lee, Shanae Eleven, Jennifer Wong, and Sukrutha Bhaduria. Our lead producer for this week's show is, hello, Catherine Miskowski, and Taki Telenidis edited our show. A lot of people here at Reveal helped out this week, including senior editors Ziva Brandstetter and Michael Corey. Special thanks to Eric Segarra, Christina Kim, Professor Donald Tomaszkiewicz-Devi, and the team at the Center for Employment Equity. And from Bloomberg News, Pia Gadkari, Liz Smith, Magnus Hendrickson, Francesca Levy, and Christy Westgaard. Thanks to all the incredible singers in our Silicon Valley Choir and Stephen Schneider of the First Unitarian Church of Oakland. Our production manager is Mwende Anaosa. Our sound design team is the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. They had help this week from Catherine Raimondo, Caitlin Benz, and Kat Shookman. Our CEO is Krista Scharfenberg. Our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camerato, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reeve and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine G. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Ledson, and remember...
Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/reveal. That's odoo.com/reveal. Odoo, modern management made simple. From PR.